this is your Polycast for Thursday, July 31st, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, the Republican candidates for governor debate. Twin Cities Archbishop John Neinstedt says he won't resign. Target has picked a Pepsi executive as its new CEO. Tim Nelson has more.
The company announced this morning that Brian Cornell will be Target's new chief executive. The 55-year-old has most recently been the chief executive of PepsiCo America's Foods, the largest of Pepsi's four divisions. Before joining that company in 2012, he was the CEO of Sam's Club, the warehouse store division of Walmart stores. He also served as an executive at Michael's Stores and the Safeway supermarket chain. He succeeds Greg Steinhoffel, who resigned in May after a data breach released information on millions of customers and their credit cards last year. Steinhoffel also oversaw a disappointing expansion of Target stores into Canada. Cornell is the first chief executive from outside Target's ranks, although he has other Minnesota ties. He serves on the board of directors at Polaris Industries, the off-road vehicle maker. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
With less than 2 weeks to go until the August 12th primary, the four Republicans who want to be governor are starting to sharpen their attacks on each other. The GOP candidates used an NPR news debate yesterday to make their case for why they're the best choice to take on DFL Governor Mark Dayton in the fall. Tim Pugmire has more.
All four candidates are pledging to cut taxes and reduce state spending, but their competing strategies for meeting those goals are starting to cause some campaign friction. Former business executive Scott Honor said he has a bold agenda for making real reductions in state spending. He wants a 10% spending cut and plans to focus on administrative costs. But Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson took exception when Honor claimed he was the only GOP candidate calling for reduced spending. Johnson, who has the Republican endorsement, criticized Honor's across-the-board approach.
I don't think that's either realistic or wise. I think that some things government does well and some things government doesn't do well. Some things government should do, some things government shouldn't do at all. And so to say that they're all the same and we're going to treat them similarly, I don't think we should be cutting roads and bridges at all.
But Honor, a first-time candidate, accused Johnson of having a defeatist attitude toward government reform and an overly cautious and slow approach to the budget. He said that's a problem shared by people who've been in government too long.
One of the things I've learned in business is when you see something going the wrong way, change it quickly. And we need to get, you know, the scale of this government reined in. We need to reduce spending. We need to have government go back to a more limited role and do the things it needs to do well.
There was some additional friction when former House Speaker Kurt Zellers boasted that he passed a two-year budget in 2011 that cut the size of government by 6%. And reduce the cost of government by 8%. That budget also ended a state government shutdown. Former State Representative Marty Seifert took exception with Zellers and his numbers.
I would have vetoed the budget that Kurt Zellers passed in 2011. It did not downsize government enough. It did not reform government enough. It borrowed from tobacco bonds. It borrowed from the schools. I would have vetoed the budget and returned it to the legislature. I would have vetoed the stadium bill that also passed.
Zellers quickly countered that Seifert and Johnson both voted for budgets that included school borrowing during their time in the legislature. But Zellers said he wanted to keep his focus on Governor Dayton rather than his primary rivals. He also reminded those rivals that they still need to work with the DFL Senate.
Whatever you're going to get passed, whatever you're going to accomplish, whether they be specifics or platitudes, is going to have to get past Tom Bach and a Democrat-controlled Senate.
For at least 2 years.
For at least 2 years. So that's if whatever you're saying here today sounds great in the studio on paper, but what is he going to sign?
The GOP candidates also emphasize their support for voluntary union membership, fewer regulations for businesses, greater accountability for public schools, and a transportation spending plan that focuses on roads rather than light rail. Seifert is the only one of the four who will skip an evening debate on a Twin Cities radio station. They'll meet up again Thursday on the radio in Duluth and at next week's Farm Fest near Redwood Falls. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Faced with growing calls for his resignation, Archbishop John Neinstedt has come forward to defend his handling of the clergy sexual abuse scandal. In his first broadcast interview since the scandal broke last September, Neinstedt told reporter Madeline Barron yesterday that he has no plans to leave his position as head of the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis. Neinstedt defended his decisions and said some have tried to discredit him with rumors of sexual misconduct. Madeline Barron has more.
For months, Neinstedt has told his colleagues at the Chancery in St. Paul, "I am not a quitter." When I spoke with him yesterday, he made it clear that he has no plans to resign. He says he's been misunderstood over the past year, as Catholics reacted to reports from NPR News that showed Neinstedt and other bishops protected priests accused of sexually abusing children.
You know, I think the role of the bishop is that of more of a father figure to a spiritual community of faith as opposed to a CEO. And I think there's a momentum here that we're much better off today than we were. And I want to be a part of that, and I want to continue to lend my support to that. We've learned an awful lot of stuff over the last 10 months, and I think that we're ready to move on to a better place.
Neinstedt says he's been working hard to follow the recommendations of a task force he created last year to address the church's procedures for handling abuse allegations. He says an outside firm has reviewed 3,000 clergy files and that the Archdiocese has changed its policy on responding to complaints of abuse.
Do you think that people will be able to trust you and to follow you?
Well, I read all my mail and all my emails that I get, and there's decidedly a group of people who have lost trust, but I think there's more than that number of people who have told me, hang in there, you know, you're doing a good job, and you know, we're going to get through this and be in a better place. So I think the you're getting one side of the story, but I see both sides of the story. And I believe that what we're going to do in the next few months is going to convince people that we're on the right track.
Neinstedt defended his decisions on several abuse cases. He says he did listen to the advice of his former chancellor, Jennifer Hasselberger, in some cases, and cut off some payments to abusive priests.
But, you know, you have to understand how the office works here. You've got several things coming at you every day. And so I had to deal with them as they came up one by one by one, you know.
Documents obtained by NPR News and published over the past year show that Neinstedt knew of problems with the Archdiocese handling of clergy sex abuse from his first month on the job, and that Hasselberger repeatedly warned him that the Archdiocese wasn't following Vatican rules. Still, the Archbishop says he was caught off guard by the reports from NPR News.
The surprise that took place when those reports started coming out last October was the breadth of the issues. And I, in a sense, didn't see the forest for the trees. I was aware of certain problems with misconduct on the part of different priests on a day-to-day basis, but I didn't get the overall picture of where we stood that someone like Jennifer, who dealt with the files every day, would have had.
So there was never a moment where you said, wait a minute, what's going on here? Big picture. It was always, here's another individual problem that we need to decide how to handle?
We were dealing with these individual situations, yes.
Okay.
And so the whole scope of the thing was not made known to me.
Neinstedt defended his decision in 2009 to appoint Father Curtis Waymire as pastor of two parishes. Hasselberger had warned Neinstedt to look at the priest's file because she was alarmed by his sexual interest in younger men. Waymire went on to sexually abuse two boys at his parish. He's now in prison.
Why did you take the risk of appointing Father Waymire pastor?
Well, I didn't think it was a risk, number one. When Jennifer brought up her objections to him being made pastor, I reviewed the file that she prepared for me. I saw that he had same-sex attractions, which doesn't preclude one from becoming a pastor. He had been gone to St. Luke's, and this was 5 years later. He had done everything they had asked him to do. He was doing spiritual direction every month. He was seeing a therapist. But there was nothing at the time that I made him pastor that I felt was serious enough to not make him a pastor. Jennifer didn't agree, but Jennifer had had a couple of run-ins with him.
So you think it was more of a personal disagreement?
I think so.
So some of the things that have been more alarming to people that have been responding to our initial reporting on Father Waymire are the incidents like in the bookstore where he's approaching these younger men, at least according to them, saying sexually explicit things. Those kinds of statements don't disqualify someone from becoming the pastor?
Well, he had gone to St. Luke's and had been evaluated and had received a treatment. It had been 5 years since anything like that had happened. And I believe that people can reform and be reformed and learn from their mistakes.
Do you think it was a mistake to appoint a pastor, looking back on it now?
Well, I did that appointment with the best lights of the judgment I could make. I consulted the Comprehensive Assignment Board, as I do in every instance of making a priest a pastor. And there were no objections from that group. That's the representative group of priests who are elected according to different age levels of the priests. I consulted my auxiliary bishop, and except for Jennifer, there was really no objection. So I felt he was ready and able and certainly willing to take on that that position.
Neinstedt also faces scrutiny from a private investigation he commissioned into his own private life. The Archbishop declined to say much about that investigation. NPR News has previously reported that the investigation involves at least one allegation that Neinstedt engaged in sexual misconduct with an adult. Why did you decide to commission the investigation into yourself?
Well, it was around the time that that other false accusation was made against me about the confirmation candidate. And all of a sudden, it seemed like rumors and innuendos were coming out of the woodwork. And I didn't have anything to hide. I know that I've not done anything immoral or criminal or anything that of that nature. And so when this came to the attention of my staff, they said, well, we should probably investigate it. We would with any priest. And I said, sure, I have nothing to hide.
What is it that is being investigated as far as you understand it?
Well, I can't get into that because when I started the investigation, I handed the authority of that over to Bishop Beauchamp. And I told him that I would not interfere. So it really would be inappropriate for me to comment on that at this time. I'm very hopeful that they're near the end of this thing and that we can get some resolution of it as soon as possible.
And what does the end look like? What will happen at the very end of it to close it?
I have no idea because I'm not involved in it day to day.
Neinstedt says the Archdiocese is paying for the investigation, but that he doesn't know how much it costs. What is being alleged here as far as what the lawyers are telling people is that you have engaged in sexually inappropriate behavior or advances with other men. Is that true?
It is not true, no.
And that there are more than one of these rumors that are going around. Is that your understanding, that they are looking into more than one allegation?
Yes. How many? I'm not sure the whole number, but I believe it's more than one, yes.
And that this involves in situations that are alleged to have occurred in Detroit and elsewhere. Are you aware of the scope of it in that sense?
Well, I was interviewed by the interviewers, and they came up with different situations, so yes. But again, I really shouldn't be commenting on the investigation itself.
The lawyers in charge of the investigation told Hasselberger that they were looking into whether Neinstedt had an inappropriate relationship with Father Wehmeyer.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely false. Father Wehmeyer had me over for dinner the first night that I went to bless his altar. I made him pastor, and then he had a DWI, I think in the fall of 2009. I called him to find out how he was doing, as I call every other priest. He said he was going stir crazy. I said, well, how about if I take you out for dinner? So I did. And then he reciprocated some months later. When he was back driving at a restaurant owned by a friend of his. So that would have been 3 meals in 3 years. I don't know that that's an inappropriate relationship.
Neinstedt says he's not sexually attracted to men.
And I also want to say that I'm not anti-gay. A lot of the feedback I got during the marriage amendment was the fact that I was a bigot and I was a homophobe and all this kind of stuff. I respect every person, man, woman, and child, for their dignity as a son and daughter of God. No, I'm not struggling with those attractions.
Neinstedt says he thinks the allegations against him are part of an attempt to discredit him for preaching the Catholic faith.
I think if you can shoot the messenger, then you hope the message goes away.
Neinstedt says he hasn't been interviewed by police who have been investigating the Archdiocese's handling of abuse complaints. And he says the Archdiocese hasn't decided whether to file for bankruptcy in response to dozens of lawsuits filed by alleged victims of clergy sexual abuse. He says he's taking a wait-and-see approach to that issue. Madeline Barron, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's your Polycast for this Thursday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.